world we're living in. Let me tell ya. And it's a world that man can eat at all. When things are big, that should be small. Who can tell what magic spells we'll be doing for us? And I'm giving all my love to this world, only to be told. I can't see, I can't breathe, nor my will we be. And now this gonna change the way we live. Cause we can always take but never give. And now the things are changing for the worse. See, whoa, it's a crazy world we're living in. And I just can't see that half of us immersed in sin.
That's the British acid jazz band Jamiroquai with Virtual Insanity. Get where we're going? Of course, that's where we're going. We are witnessing virtual insanity. And it is coming by way of a curious concatenation, if you will, of events both within the United States and outside of the United States, spurred on by the attacks last Friday in Paris, the terrorist attacks in Paris that killed upwards of 130 people, injuring hundreds more. And as awful as the situation is, and as urgent the need to identify who is responsible and why, and these things are to be expected. People want revenge. They want to basically apprehend these people and so forth. That is correct. That is the correct and expected response. But in the middle of all of that, a number of agendas are neatly being fit into all kinds of plans, and we have to be aware of that. Certainly in Europe, we have been discussing on this program open Islamophobia, xenophobia, anti-immigrant sentiment rising throughout Europe, the rise of the rabid right. This event, this tragedy, fits neatly into an agenda that you would use this tragedy for political gain. We have politicians all throughout Europe, heads of state, with fragile political careers under attack because of their political stances, one way or the other, within their parties and within their countries. This allows them a forum to affirm their authority. And as we saw and we spoke about it on Monday, we can anticipate in France the elastic, lots of elastic being put into the authority of the state. And our guest, Gilbert Mercier, talked to us about the clear evidence that President Hollande has already begun that process, seeking to extend, if you will, martial law for another 3 months. We see in Russia, we have a move as well, Russia having taken a lead role in the bombardment of ISIS in Syria, initially condemned by the United States and its allies for doing so, despite the fact that there was inertia. The United States had taken, President Obama had said originally, that he had no strategy. And suddenly there is a strategy, because the prevailing political conditions make him make it appropriate for him now, and in fact necessary for him to have a strategy. So that is happening. We have the various political candidates on the Republican and Democratic sides using this as a way to shore up the burgeoning anti-immigrant sentiment here and the open and unfettered anti-Islamic sentiment, growing Islamic sentiment here in the United States. In fact, we have several governors insisting that they would even go one step further. Governors of several states, more than half of the states, taking a position as recently as yesterday, saying, we are not going to accept any Syrian refugees into the United States, although this is federal policy, and technically they have no say over this. They have to accept refugees wherever the refugees wish to go. But we have as many as 27 governors saying, we will not accept Syrians in our states. I mean, this is what happens. And so in little pockets, you see a huge event like this, bringing together all these various political forces and interests who share a narrow agenda. They have narrow agendas, but these events are the kinds of things that allow them to consolidate effort. It looks as if now they are of one mind, but they're not. They're still well within narrow interests. But it will be made to look as if there's unanimity of agreement, and therefore it will look as if there is an amassing of strength behind a single idea, and that is to fight terrorism. Well, we're not so naive, are we, as to believe that it is as simple as that? And yet we can't deny that it is an awful tragedy. It's a beastly thing to contemplate and to implement the execution, the murder on a mass scale of individuals who have done nothing wrong except they were in the appropriate place at the appropriate time for these nefarious acts to be committed. But watch what is happening in the United States in particular. All these latent sentiments, these racist sentiments, these sentiments of intolerance, that for the sake of, well, I could call it politics and public relations, were just buried a little bit under the skin, not too far beneath it, but they were there, these sentiments. But for, you know, public relations, they couldn't be so blatant. We do have the crass people like Donald Trump and others who felt no need to disguise their racist proclivities. But others said, well, you know, it's a kind of gentler kind of racism. We will park it a little bit under the skin for the moment. Although in everything they said relating to immigration policy, relating to Islam, relating to Muslims, and so forth, everything they said suggested that those, in fact, were their sentiments. Now, when these things happen, it provides the perfect environment for people to seize upon them and to read the temperature. In some of these cases, we have the media playing its role in shaping public sentiment, in helping people to become numb to the things that they would normally say matter to them, like fairness and, you know, equality and so forth. All of that gets thrown out the window, and the media play a major role in just drumming up these kinds of sentiments so as to permit the broader agenda to go forward. Now, when we are in a moment like this, sometimes we don't recognize it because history is actually unfolding before our eyes and we are in the moment. But perhaps because we are in the moment, we don't appreciate the historicity of the event until years will go by, decades perhaps, and then we realize we were witnessing the unfolding of history. I would suggest to you that we are in such a moment. And it is not specific to this event, although we cannot dismiss the impact of this event, but we are in a moment in which, a transformative moment, if you will, because this is shaping global opinion, global action, global thought, global policy. And the sentiments that are driving this are as old as they could be. Hatred of one group of people or by one group of people toward another. I want to share with you today a presentation made by Tariq Ali. He is a Pakistani. He lives in Britain. He's been living in Britain for many, many years. He is a writer. He is a polemicist. He is an activist, author of many books. And he has an interesting way of looking at this. He casts the issue of terrorism in a broader perspective. And this is where we need to start our thinking about this, I think. He's speaking here in 2010, 5 years ago in October, at a convention of unconventional people. The convention is called the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. It was held in Sydney, Australia, and brought together some of the leading minds exploring from a very, quote, dangerous, unquote, intellectual perspective, some ideas. And the dangerous idea he puts forward here is, what can we learn from terrorists? I found it very fascinating, and we don't have the time to play the entire lecture, but I do want to share with you what he presented for consideration when he spoke back in 2010. What he tells the audience, and what he will be telling us today, is that you have to look at terrorism in a very different way. Certainly not to countenance it, not to excuse it at all, but to understand that, like almost everything else, terrorism does not happen in a vacuum. And more importantly, terrorism is not the sole domain of people from the Middle East. Terrorism has been, it's in fact, defined and redefined depending on the political climate. Some people's terrorists are other people's freedom fighters. We will learn that today from Tariq Ali. So here I want to present this. It's really a good portion of the presentation that he made, but I bring it to your attention because we are witnessing the same kind of concatenation of events happening in different pockets all over the place, looking as if they are disconnected from each other, but in fact really are connected to each other. Tariq Ali on what can we learn from terrorists?
Now, the subject for this evening, what we can learn from the terrorists, seems very provocative, but actually, by the time I've finished, I hope you'll see that it's quite commonsensical. Though, of course, it challenges the dominant ideas of the day. And I will also talk a bit about history and the history of terrorism, because contrary to what people imagine, terrorism was neither spawned by Islam or that religion, and nor will it end with it. This is something which has existed for some time, and the word is often misused. It's applied to liberation movements, it's applied to people who have been struggling for freedom, it's applied to people who tried to chuck the Brits out of Africa, Cyprus, India. They were called terrorists, and then when the British were forced to sit at the table with them and do deals with them, they suddenly were transformed into statesmen. So one shouldn't take appellations too seriously. If you look back, I mean, if you look at the world today, I would say that we are living through a period of transition. And the interesting thing about periods of transition is that people normally living through them don't realize it's a transition. For them, it's everyday life. It's the problems they have to deal with. But I think it is a period of transition, and it's a period of transition which opened up in the late 90s after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, because with that collapse also collapsed ideologies, interrelated but of a different kind. One, of course, was communism and that whole world, but the second, which has been less talked about as collapsing, but which collapsed nonetheless, was social democracy. And the collapse of social democracy helped to create a vacuum which is very similar to a vacuum which existed in the late 19th century. Now, I don't want to dwell too long on this, but if you look back, the defeats inflicted on the revolutions, which were democratic revolutions of 1848 and which erupted all over Europe with people demanding freedom, rights, electoral rights, an end to oligarchic rule, an end to the dictatorship of the rich, as they called it, followed by the big eruption of the Paris Commune in 1871, brutally crushed, partially by Bismarck, but largely by reactionary forces within. And after that, you had a period of transition. And that period of transition was a situation where you had a concert of powers, big powers. There was no one dominant power, but you had a concert of powers whose main goal was to try and keep the populations of Europe and North America, though that was distant, down. Keep the populations under control. And that attempt to keep populations under control through repression, through the lack of civil liberties, through not permitting political organizations, created an atmosphere where a whole bunch of anarchist groups arose. Anarchism was the dominant philosophy of large sections of the European left. And they believed in what they called the propaganda of the deed, by which they meant bumping off emperors and presidents, because they thought that would have a big impact, and in some cases they thought that if you killed the Tsar of Russia or the President of France, the society would come tumbling down. Of course, it never did, but the actions in themselves, there is absolutely no doubt, were popular. And the result of these actions was large-scale repression. And this repression only increased the size of those protesting. And the successes of the anarchist terrorists, and they didn't decline that name, by the way, the effect of this was to some extent, there's no doubt about it, was to raise consciousness. And if you look at 19th century Europe, you know, there were sort of strange things going on. There was a strike by the weavers of Lyon in France, and the strike was defeated. And there is a report of two weavers marching, walking all the way from Lyon to Paris, and asking a bystander, where does the bourgeoisie live? And when the bystander said, but what do you mean? And they said, well, where do they live? And he said, why do you want to know? And they said, we've come to blow them up. Now, that's a sort of very simple request, but deep underneath it was an anger, a bitterness, and a hatred over the conditions in which they lived. And one guy, one anarchist, whose wife and children were dying, literally dying of starvation, thought he was going to die too because they had no food to eat. And he thought, I'll throw a bomb in the French Chamber of Deputies, the French Parliament, just to wake them up. And he did. A few members of Parliament were injured. No one died. The guy was caught, sentenced to death, and guillotined. And immediately another anarchist came in his place and said, okay, and announced in public, for what he has done, I am going to assassinate President Carnot, who refused to sign life imprisonment to spare his life. And he did it. And when he was being tried, he said, they said to him, but in your attempt to kill the president, you kill lots of innocent people. And he said, there are no innocents. Quite chilling. And then he said this. His name was Emile Henry, Henri Henry. I was convinced that the existing organization of society was bad. I wanted to struggle against it so as to hasten its disappearance. I brought to the struggle a profound hatred, intensified every day by the revolting spectacle of a society where all is base, all is cowardly, where everything is a barrier to the development of human passions, to generous tendencies of the heart, to the free flight of thought. I wanted to show the bourgeoisie that their pleasures would be disturbed, that their golden calf would tremble violently on its pedestal until the final shock would cast it down in mud and blood. We do not spare bourgeois women and children because the wives and children of those we love are not spared either. Are not those children innocent victims who in the slums die slowly of anemia because bread is scarce at home? Or those women who grow pale in your workshops and wear themselves out to earn 40 sous a day and yet are lucky when poverty does not turn them into prostitutes? Those old people whom you have turned into machines for production all their lives and whom you cast on the garbage dump and into the workhouse when their strength is exhausted. At least have the courage of your crimes, gentlemen of the bourgeoisie, and agree that our reprisals are fully legitimate. You have hanged men in Chicago, cut off their heads in Germany, strangled them in Jerez, shot them in Barcelona, guillotined them in Montbrison and Paris, but what you will never destroy is anarchism. Its roots are too deep. It is born in the heart of a corrupt society which is falling to pieces. He was hanged. He was executed. But what happened after this phase of violent attacks all over Europe and North America, especially the United States, what happened was that political parties, political movements emerged. Trade unions emerged. organizations emerged which fought for the same aims and the same goals in a different way, by mobilizing large numbers of ordinary people, by challenging bourgeois parties in elections, and by trying to create a better world. Now, to a certain extent they succeeded, and to some extent they did not. I want to compare this period I've just been talking about with what has happened to the world since the 90s. We have a concert of powers again, where the world basically kowtows before the United States, and that is different, because now we have a world hegemon, the only imperial power in the world, with more resources, military resources, than the next 10 countries put together. And this power feels that it can rule the world as it wishes and can do what it wants, and the powers of the European Union and the Far Eastern states, and obviously Australia, that goes without saying, fall into line, do what they are asked to do, despite the fact that in many cases the citizens of these countries do not like what is being done in their name and are powerless to stop it. So you had a consensus economically, where we were told that the only model of capitalism on offer was neoliberal capitalism, end of state intervention, end of helping, sustaining, strengthening a social welfare state, privatizations. If it moved, if it could make a profit, privatize it. Water, electricity, all the basic needs of citizens were privatized. And you were not allowed to challenge this. And a new language emerged, the language of neoliberalism, where all this was described as reforms. And if you challenged it, you were accused of being hostile to reforms. You were not modern enough. And this has been going on till the crash of 2008, when suddenly this entire system, feeding in on itself, creating a world of debt and crazed consumerism and circuses, usually in the realm of sports, enjoy, just don't ask too many questions, don't worry, be happy. This system that was created received a severe shock in 2008 when it was on the verge of collapse. And when it was on the verge of collapse, all these people who had been attacking state intervention for the last 20 years went on their knees and asked for bailouts. And the state intervened and spent billions and billions and billions of dollars and pounds and euros to bail out failing banks. And then they have the nerve to say, don't challenge us. Because if even a slight challenge, they're called statist. But they're the ones who are statists. They bailed out their own system. When that same amount of money is demanded for health, for education, it's not available. And this is a situation, by the way, in most parts of the Western world, and increasingly now in many parts of Asia. If this was the economic system, you had a foreign policy which was based on war, and here we come to the modern form of terrorism. The attacks by Al-Qaeda on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon in 9/11 became the rallying cry for the war against terror. And we are still into those wars. And you know, however savage the terrorists can be, and they can be and are, the base revenge that is exacted on them by the state leaves their savagery, it pales into comparison. Because just look at what has happened to the world since 9/11. Iraq occupied by the United States and allied countries, Australia, Britain, not France and Germany in this case, Spain, Portugal, a few others. And the balance sheet of the war in Iraq is now over 1 million Iraqis dead, 3.5 million severely wounded, 5.5 million orphans, the entire social infrastructure of that country destroyed. If this is not state terrorism, what is? What is the damage? Much, much worse than anything Saddam Hussein did. And the country now handed over to confessional parties on the payroll of Iran. And then they are worried. Now they have to threaten Iran in order to get some concessions in Iraq. That's the game that's being played at the moment. But it's their policies that did it. Then we had that this war is a disaster is now acknowledged by most people, most thinking people. But then we have the other war in Afghanistan, and this was meant to be the good war. And this was totally nothing more than a war of revenge. The Al-Qaeda headquarters were in Afghanistan, in the caves. And Bush said, we're going to take them out. And when asked, what are your war aims? He said, the head of Osama bin Laden dead or alive, and the head of Mullah Omar dead or alive. Well, you know, if you demand heads, you can't have live heads given to you. They're usually the dead people if you're going to cut them off. But they haven't managed to achieve that since October 2001, because bin Laden and his group disappeared, and Mullah Omar, a badly wounded guy with one eye, none of their surveillance people could find out where he was or track him. I'm told he's somewhere in Pakistan, where he often gives press conferences. But the great and powerful United States couldn't track him down, so we've had a war going on now for a long time, since October 2001, longer than the First World War, longer than the Second World War. And large numbers of Afghan civilians in their tens of thousands are dying. And since Obama came to power, this is something which I explain in detail in my book, there have been more drone attacks on Pakistan in the last 2 years than there were in the 8 years of the Bush administration. So as far as Afghanistan, Pakistan, or AFPAC, as Obama called it, the situation is much worse. Much, much worse than it was before. And auxiliary political leaders, like your own, whether they happen to be Tories or Labour, it doesn't matter in this case, trying to find some justification for keeping Australian troops in Afghanistan, head off to Kabul to meet Karzai and then come back and assure Parliament that they met the President of Afghanistan and those things are not good, they have reassured that they need to keep the troops there. The pattern is the same, whether it's a German leader, a British leader, they go to Kabul, meet him, come back and say the same statement. But the situation is that you have a tiny, corrupt clique of politicians running that country who have only their own interests at heart, who are making money hand over fist. The Karzai family is now the richest in Afghanistan. People around him are building huge villas on state lands, which they've confiscated. And at the same time, you have on the edges of Kabul one of the largest slums now in South Asia. It's not as large as the slum in Karachi, but it is getting that way. So you see the difference in lifestyles very clearly. It's not hidden. And then they imagine that people are going to be pleased that the country is occupied. And there's no way out. Obama knows it. General Eikenberry, the U.S. ambassador in Kabul, knows it and was against the surge. and advised Obama to seek an exit strategy, not send more troops, overruled by Obama on the advice of General Petraeus. And this General Petraeus has recently been quoted in the American press as saying, well, I know the war is unwinnable. We can't win this war, but we have to carry on fighting it, and our children have to carry on after we've gone. What is this? War for its own sake? War to sustain and fuel a permanent war economy in the United States because they think it's good for the country, good for its economy? Or what? But that is what is going on. Have no doubt about it. And meanwhile, both Iraq and Afghanistan have actually helped, and this is now confirmed by every single Western intelligence agency, actually helped to create more, within inverted commas, terrorists. Because there, you know, there's the Al-Qaeda group, which is very small, but there are now, and actually the West has learned not to call everyone who fights them terrorists, which is a small step forward. They refer to them as insurgents. And when people like myself say it's a resistance, they say, no, no, please don't use the word resistance. Because somehow resistance is a good word since it was employed and deployed during the Second World War in the struggle against the Third Reich. But I said, you know, there are different kinds of resistance. We call the Vietnamese struggle against the American troops and Australian and South Korean auxiliaries as a resistance. And so there is a resistance in Iraq. There is a resistance in Palestine, however weakened. And we have a situation where human rights have been elevated, or were, if they're not used that much now. But all this was being done in the name of human rights, we were told. But they've stopped saying that now after the results in Iraq. And to be perfectly frank, had any other country done to Iraq what the United States and its allies have done, there would have been no question. No question. Their leaders would have been charged with war crimes and taken before the Hague Tribunal. I mean, Milosevic tried before the Hague Tribunal for the death of 1,500, just under 2,000 Kosovans, and not the perpetrators of the war in Iraq. What is this world, if not a world of grotesque double standards? Saddam handed over to a lynch mob and photographed while he's being hanged, but nothing happens because they are the rulers of the world, and they can get away, and they do get away with murder. So the one thing that can be learnt from all these wars is that they cannot be solved by war, by violence, by bombings. Countries, poor countries like Afghanistan and parts of Pakistan, where people live in appalling conditions. I mean, recently the floods in Pakistan were so horrific that it's difficult to even describe them, leaving 24 million people homeless. And in one area of Pakistan, in Sindh, near Jacobabad, when the government of the country, the health department, pleaded for helicopters from an Air Force base, they were told that the base was under the control of the Americans and they were not allowing it to be used for helping the flood victims because they were loading and sending drones from that air base to hit villages close to the Afghan frontier. And this happens, and Western citizens look and watch, horrified in many cases, against it, but paralyzed. Unable to act, because mainstream politics now, as in the last years of the 19th century, is dominated by political currents, elites, which do the bidding of the United States economically, politically, and in world politics. And so one shouldn't be too surprised that this creates a fertile atmosphere for individuals who say, nothing can be done, let me go and blow myself up and I'll take a few of the enemy with me. Now, I don't think this is a good thing, don't get me wrong, but I do understand it. And I try and contextualize it, that no one acts for them. No one gives voice to the anger, bitterness of Palestinians who have been under the iron heel of Israel now for a long, long time. And the Israelis can and do get away with systematic murder, with torture, with killing children. If you look at the United Nations Goldstein Tribunal reports, not what his judgment said, which even that was too harsh for the Israelis, but you go on the website and just look at the evidence which Justice Goldstein heard, it is outrageous what happened. Absolutely outrageous. But that's fine, because we can't say anything to the Israelis because of what Europeans did to the Jews during the Second World War, which was a horrendous crime, but it was not a crime committed by the Arab people or the Palestinians. And they are being punished for it. In fact, the Palestinians have become the indirect victims of the Judeocide that took place in Europe. It was not their fault, but they are suffering as a result. And partially the guilty conscience of the Europeans. After all, had they wanted, the United States and Britain could have blasted those concentration camps. That's what they were being asked to do by many Jewish leaders. Blow us up, never mind, we're going to die anyway, destroy the camps. Can't spare the planes. And imbecilic political leaders like Tony Blair go around saying the Second World War was a war to defend the Jewish people. He actually said that. So I said, if that's the case, then it was a huge defeat. Because you failed. So the key thing one has to understand is that where there is no opposition, meaningful opposition, in this vacuum, individual groups, individuals will take recourse to violent acts because they feel that is the only way. Only way they can move forward. And there is an interesting contrast between the rest of the world and what is happening in South America. I mean, it's not all bad. South America, where you threw up giant social movements 15 years ago against privatization, against electricity privatization, against water privatization, against the assault on them by the Washington Consensus and the IMF, they fought back. And I always say to European trade unions, you should learn a lesson from the peasants of Bolivia and Peru, who, despite the fact that they have less political education, succeeded in fighting and winning. And on the basis of their victories against that form of privatization, they created political parties, the Movement for Socialism in Bolivia, which won 2 elections, 3 elections continuously and gave Evo Morales, an indigenous leader, made him president of Bolivia. There's 70% of Bolivians are indigenous, and this is the first time an indigenous leader has become president of Bolivia, to the shock and horror of the Creole elite, which can't believe what has happened because they got so used to ruling. Chavez in Venezuela, Correa in Ecuador, and even in Brazil, very different in many ways. Some change is taking place. People are mobilized. So the events in the mood in South America is very different from the mood elsewhere. And lastly, we come to this region where, look, the big powers in the region where Australia is situated are China and Japan. These are the countries, if any Australian government was sensible, these are the countries you have to work with, deal with, fight with. But that should be the sphere of activity for Australia, but it is so tied to the coattails of the old British Empire and those who succeeded it, the United States, that that still dominates the mentality of the Australian ruling class, which is short-sighted. Of course, it is true that of all the countries that came out of the Second World War, Japan remains occupied. Japan is not allowed its own foreign policy. When a government was elected in Japan a few months ago on the slogan of getting the American troops out of Okinawa, because the Okinawans are fed up of having American military bases there. I don't want to go into details. You can read about it, rapes, fights. They've had enough. They wanted it out. A political party saying it would do this is elected, comes to power. Gates, the defense secretary of the United States and Obama, hop on the plane, go to Japan and say, what the hell do you think you're up to? And more or less get rid of him. So Japan is not allowed its own foreign policy. It's been nuked, two of its cities destroyed. It had to sign the US-Japan security treaty under cover of darkness because they were scared if they signed it during the day, the students and the population would lay siege to parliament. They've made all those concessions and still they are not permitted total independence. That is what happens when you have a world hegemon, unchallenged, but challengeable. And then you have the new rise of China, which is the story of the 21st century. That China has become today what Britain was in the 19th century. The workshop of the world, with all that that entails. So all these changes are taking place, and they will have consequences over the next 10 or 15 years. And that is why those who challenge the current consensus carried out by center-left and center-right, so that it doesn't really matter who wins, then people get fed up after 5 years of a center-left government and get rid of it, and the center-right comes. After 5 years, they're fed up of that. Get rid of the incumbent. That seems to be the only politics on offer. And these are things which go back a long, long way. And a very great novelist of this region, taken as a whole, Jose Rizal, the great Filipino novelist and patriot, wrote a couple of novels at the end of the 19th century, in which he said something which, you know, give or take a few words, is still quite relevant. And I'm going to read that extract out just to show you how little has changed. This is Rizal's words in his chapter called La Última Razón, The Final Argument, in his famous novel El Filibusterismo, translated as The Subversive. The world will applaud, as always, legitimizing the more powerful and the more violent. Europe applauded when the nations of the West sacrificed the lives of millions of Indios in America, and definitely not in order to found other nations far more moral or peace-loving. Yonder stands the North with its egoistic liberty, its lynch laws, its political manipulations. Yonder stands the South with its turbulent republic, its barbarism, its civil wars, its pronunciamentos like its mother, Spain. Europe applauded when a powerful Portugal plundered the Moluccas, and now applauds as England destroys in the Pacific region the local primitive races in order to implant that of its own immigrants. Europe will applaud us as it applauds the end of a drama, the denouement of a tragedy. The common people barely notice the basis of what is happening. They simply observe its effects. And that is very similar, I feel, to what is going on today in Europe, in America, in Australia, in countries which I have described as the concert of powers who follow the world hegemon. And unless oppositions grow and develop and bring about a change, this situation will continue. And as long as this situation continues, you will have terrorist groups of one sort or another. And the thing to understand is this: the methods employed by these groups are savage, wrong. I've criticized them many a time. But to simply call them terrorists and ignore the demands that they are making is equally foolish. Because if you don't understand why they are doing this, and the reason they are doing it, they may be genuine, they may not be genuine, that's irrelevant. The reasons they give for doing it are the American occupation of the Middle East, the failure to solve the question of Palestine. These are the things that come up time and time and time again. Now, of course, they're not going to be solved by acts of terror, but nor are they going to be solved by what the West, principally the United States and its allies, are doing. They need political solutions. And when you go for political solutions, then you can't support one side, as the United States does in Israel-Palestine. So these are questions which are not going to go away. There are no easy solutions, but one solution is there: for individual citizens not to remain passive, to challenge what is done in their name, and to create meaningful alternatives. Thank you.
That was Tariq Ali speaking 5 years ago in Sydney, Australia, about what we can learn from terrorists. And I'm sure listening to the content, you see the depth to which we have to go to basically dismiss the conditioning that we are getting from the media, from politicians, from entire world systems, to train us into disconnecting their past, their deeds, from current crises. In fact, I commented just yesterday, there was the great social democrat, Bernie Sanders, standing right next to somebody who belongs before the International Criminal Court, Hillary Rodham Clinton. And everybody agreed that they're not going to raise the question about the connection between U.S. foreign policy and the acts of terrorism we're seeing. In the same way, France's foreign policy should be questioned, Israel's foreign policy should be questioned, Britain's foreign policy should be questioned, and so forth. I hope this was important to you, and I hope you gained something from listening to this point of view. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking about these programs. You can write me at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye. Well,